headlight or have a fancier name on it. So everyone, for the most part, has kind of bought into the disposable nature of consumerism. And, you know, if you want to try and fight against it, so be it. But you kind of narrow your consumer base by doing that. No one out there cares, unfortunately, anymore that a refrigerator at best is going to last them maybe 5, 6, 7 years. That the days of a 20 or a 30 year old refrigerator are long since gone.
You mentioned consumerism. Question: does consumption behavior affect environmental quality?
Well, I think so, and I think it's been sort of demonstrated. It's not harmless to the environment to mine for all these materials, and it's very difficult to return them to industry. You have people breaking open old computers and old electrical equipment to try and get back some of the gold, but there is a lot of stuff that spreads so thin in consumer goods that although they're incredibly important, they're not cost-effective to extract them. So what inevitably happens is they break open pieces of the earth and expose it to different conditions and increase the pollution and heavy metal content in the water supplies and other things. So, yeah, I think ultimately it's not a very good idea to just keep throwing stuff away and filling up landfills and then mining for rare earths to take their place. But that seems to be the track we're on, at least temporarily.
Yeah, I was always amazed with your gentle way of describing things. Consumption can affect the environment in many ways. High level of consumption and therefore higher level of production require larger inputs of energy and material and generate larger quantities of waste byproducts. And increased extraction and exploitation of natural resources, accumulation of waste and concentration of pollutants can damage the environment and on the long run limit economic activity. Let me drop. Yeah, there was one curve there I want to mention that was we can critically review the empirical findings. I mean, those who are interested with that, there is a curve known as environmental Kuznets curve, Kuznets, and there is an inverted U relationship between environmental degradation and economic growth. And for those who are interested, you might find out that we're going to the docks and to exchange.
Well, Wes, I hate to be a downer for everyone. I mean, we have enough bad news already, but the problem is that we don't have a very good sense of time. We sort of live in the present. Sometimes that's a compliment for people, that they're living in the moment. But I think a wise person is reminded of things by the past and is concerned about the future. And, yeah, we're living in the moment, but we better plan better than we're doing. So in a way, I would agree with you. I think it's ultimately a somewhat bankrupt philosophy, but would be the first time mankind came up with a bankrupt philosophy. Eventually, we're going to be forced against our will to shift to a different way of doing things. Until that point, unfortunately, people tend to do what they do. So I am not particularly optimistic in the short run, but hopefully, ultimately, people will learn from their elders' mistakes.
Papa Zulu?
Yes, Rich.
Quickly, Roy, I wonder what your take is on SDR. Because so far, my take is it's a nice enhancement, a very, very nice enhancement to the way we used to make ham radio ham radios. But basically, beyond that, beyond a nice enhancement, it's not something like Digital Revolution is turning out to be. Do you see it like that, W2BZ?
Not particularly. I see the digital voice as an interesting a field of research of technology, and as I've mentioned to you before, I think we haven't quite got to the eureka moment with it. I think there's something that digital voice mode will be very good for that no one's been able to quite figure out yet. Software-defined radio, I think, is a kind of paradigm shift, if you'll suffer that terrible phrase, in how dealing with it by removing the entire analog stage and reducing it to digital streams. You improve the quality in general. You can have filters that are adjustable on the fly and that are ringless with very sharp skirts. And also you can change feature sets by firmware. A perfect example of what the software-defined radio is quietly doing without people noticing too much is the ICOM 7300. It is almost impossible for me to talk on the HF band and have every other person I talk to tell me that they had recently bought an IC7300. It has excellent specs, it has a very good price point, and it's basically due to the fact that it's a stealth software-defined radio in a legacy sort of box. So I think software-defined radio is a whole shift in design. Again, IF, super heterodyning, super regenerative, FM modulation were all patented back in the 1910s. They've had a great run for 100 years. All this stuff can now be done more easily in the digital domain, and silicon tends to get better and cheaper over time. So, I think it's just not bells and whistles. I think it's a whole different way of looking on the future of radio technology.
WB2DAZ.
Yes, Ed.
You brought up the ICOM IC7300. It is a remarkable historical point, but I do not believe it's an end unto itself. It's the turning point. Toyota developed the Prius as the first working hybrid. Now everybody's making hybrid cars. I think the 7300 is the SDR / entering the mainstream Prius, because my Yaesu SD891 is the same idea. They're marrying SDR with analog radios, and it's magnificent. My SD891 has worked on CW. When I was a kid, if this radio had been around, I would have literally killed for it. You have variable CW selectivity, and with the direct digital synthesis tuning, it is unbelievably rock solid. I mean, single sideband comes in normally with DDS. So I'm saying we're seeing that change, and the 7300 is the first one, but it won't be the last.
AC2GS. I agree with you entirely, Ed. And, history books love to point at one particular point and say, okay, that was the inflection point. And that's wonderful when you have 20/20 hindsight. There have been SDR radios before the 7300. There will probably be incredibly great, better SDRs in the future. I just use the 7300 as one of the most obvious examples of an SDR hiding in plain sight as sort of a legacy radio that it isn't. I mean, Japanese corporations are sort of known to have a degree of conservative nature, so they wouldn't do something like Flex Radio did which was just to bring out a glorified computer with an RF connector and an interface that ran on a computer screen. They built a proper radio, filled it up with SDR components and SDR technology, and they're doing very well by it. And I'm looking forward to the ICOM 705, which is going to be a 5 to 10 watt all-in-one SDR as well. So that will be fascinating.
Do you see an SDR radio as someday bringing out signals that we cannot hear now?
Well, there's nothing inherent in software-defined radios that are going to trick the laws of physics. If you want to do something along the lines that Joe Taylor has done with his FT8 and all of his low-power modes, if you decrease the symbol rate enough and you increase the redundancy and error correction, you'll be able to get signals below the noise floor. But you'll have to use things like that in addition to the software-defined radio. The software-defined radio is not going to do magic. It just does what radios need to do very well and relatively inexpensively and are easily modified.
WB3AV will come in.
Yes, Ed.
GPS is a magnificent example of dragging signals out of the noise. And the secret is you have to have a narrow bandwidth and a way of finding that narrow signal and homing in on it. GPS does that magnificently. About 20 years ago, there were some guys experimenting with coherent CW. That the idea being, if you have a very narrow receiver bandpass, you have to make sure that you're transmitting a signal that fits in the guy's receiver's narrow bandpass. So it takes tricks with coherency and all that kind of stuff. But yes, it can be done. But the key point is you cannot do that and have a broad bandwidth. You've got to be very low data rate.
BDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Well, it's interesting. GPS is a spread spectrum system. So it depends on other factors. But the very fact of this discussion, the topics that are coming up, shows that amateur radio is very much alive. SDR has strong following. DMR has strong following. And so long as these things remain in an open source type of configuration where various hams can play around with it and do things with it, I think we're going to definitely see growth in the hobby. Right?
Actually, spread spectrum in GPS narrows the bandwidth, even though that sounds counterintuitive. It gives you the coherency you need to find the narrow signal underlying.
Yeah, the fact that the signal is transmitted wideband, but when you despread it, other interfering signals are cast aside. So it's the despreading that actually gives you the improved signal-to-noise ratio.
Okay, very good. We have agreement here. I think the short-term future for ham radio is very good. Again, this technical net is an example that there are people with questions and thoughts on the subject and willing to spend the time and the effort to learn how to do things. I think the IE article is more looking a little bit past the next 10 or say 20 years of what the future of ham radio, and I would say, who knows what the future of anything is 20 and 30 years from now. I still remember great articles, great issues of Popular Science when I was a kid. They would always go into these, how will the world of the future be in 10 years? And they almost always got it wrong because our imagination is not as good as our technical prowess in following technology into strange nooks and crannies. So I think the problem, as the IEEE sees it, is not the short-term future, but the long-term future. And for that, we have to kind of figure out how to engage the interest in 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds. We already have the interest of people who have a license, although it's always good to have them even more interested.
VDH also with a comment.
Yes, John.
Well, in light of that IEEE article, you know, there is a potential dark side to it. I hate to bring up a kind of conspiracy, but maybe some of these telephony companies are trying to get the IEEE to go along with the demise of amateur radio, because they are chomping at the bit for a lot of our UHF and microwave frequencies. They would, they are just want to eat every one of those UHF and especially the microwave frequencies up. They really want them. Hi.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially the Congress is going to have a lot of worries of where to get money from. And the cellular phone companies are looking, I think for the most part, they're really looking for the microwave frequencies. They would like to take everything from, say, 1 gig up. I don't think they particularly care that much for UHF or VHF or certainly HF. It harkens back to the bad old days when the Navy ran the regulated the radio waves, and they threw the useless stuff, which was 1.5 megahertz and above, to amateur radio operators and forbade them for doing any experimentation below 1.5 megahertz. So we figured out how to make those frequencies very useful. So, yeah, there's always that give and take, and there's always guys with checkbooks and congressmen and senators who like to bring a lot of money into government for other programs and such. And it needs a vocal and real population of amateur radio operators to keep whining and bitching and moaning. If we all just sit quietly, yeah, they'll take everything. That's human nature, unfortunately. Any other comments on this subject?
WB2ABC.
Yes, Ed.
I don't think anybody's taking 1,000 to 1,100 megahertz. You know why?
Why?
Because the new air traffic control system, as does the old one, is in that frequency band. If you ever want to fly on an airliner, you want 1,000 to 1,100 megahertz.
Okay, I agree with you. There's a lot of commercial and government and important frequency areas that are being used by all kinds of government and otherwise that they're not going to be able to sell to the cellular companies. But, you know, all things being equal, if you could serve up the entire microwave range on a platter, they would open up their checkbooks, assuming that anyone has a checkbook anymore, and pay you good money for it. So I think that those frequencies, the microwave amateur radio bands, are in danger of being turned over for a bunch of reasons. There's very little activity. I mean, some of the smartest guys in our hobby are tinkering with microwave, but that's not large numbers of them. So I could see a day where the government says, look, they offered us $1 billion, and what are you going to do? The 12 people using microwaves is going to not vote for us? I guess we'll go with $1 billion.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
There was an article from the ARRL not too long ago talking about the HF band that is an interest in people involved with stocks trying to transmit from, you know, let's say from Chicago or someplace, you know, in the United States to a stock exchange, and using HF, they could beat the, you know, satellite transmissions, or they could beat the landline transmissions. So, you know, I mean, to some extent, I could see them actually looking for, you know, HF. You can't really, it's not that easy to do with VHF. You would need
repeaters going from one location to another, but they're thinking about HF. And there was a movie along that line. It was a pretty bad movie. It was called The Hummingbird Project, where, you know, the same idea, except this guy wanted to build a digital transmission from, you know, like one, you know, from the middle of the country to New York. But the same idea was digital versus RF. Back you, Roy.
Yeah, I remember there were articles on that subject. I think I did a story on it, that you sort of would think that the underground fiber optic links would be faster than RF, but apparently it requires repeaters throughout its chain, and that seems to introduce enough latency that they think they could have made a profit by arbitraging the time difference between the fiber optic undersea line versus a RF. The problem with RF, though, is it's very difficult to have it be functional all the time. So it's the problem is maintaining the signal for any consecutive period of time. But it's a fascinating subject. I don't think anyone's going to rush out to rob us of HF because of it. I think there's more than enough little bits and pieces of the HF band that they could use for that particular purpose that they wouldn't really, and, you know, it's a very narrow cast. You know, major investment bankers would be the only people to really develop any need for it, as opposed to cell phones, where you could rationalize that, you know, these people have hundreds of millions of customers and they're all voting people. So I don't think that's going to be a problem. But, you know, who knows what the future will bring. Any other comments on this subject? Okay. Again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock. And if anyone has any other questions or comments or topics they would like to discuss of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign.
I think I sent you a few proposed subjects to discuss last week.
Yes, indeed you did. I don't exactly know how to do that without visual cues, because I think some of them really warrant it. You know, I don't know what to tell you. It's a little bit deep and heavy.
Yes, I know. So when we talk about the aspect of ham radio and the future of ham radio, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I didn't sound silly or I didn't sound heavy. And now I am. And actually, I am.
Well, I would never say silly. I don't know. I kind of let the tiger out of the cage. Talking about quantum mechanics and general relativity and time dilation here. We kind of open things up beyond amateur radio technology. It's just some things I feel that I could at least try to convey over a radio, but, you know, there are some things that just refuse to be conveyed very well without illustration.
If you were asked to find something that would interest the audience about nuclear magnetic resonance, would you be able to find something?
Well, ultimately it depends on the audience. I don't think people kind of appreciate the fact that nuclear magnetic resonance is just another name, really, for magnetic resonance imaging. It got repurposed and renamed for marketing reasons. When they slid it over from chemistry to medicine, and so, you know, if you gauge the subject in MRIs, more than a few people have had MRIs, and they might be interested in a superficial discussion.
if you start to get into the precession of nuclear particles and in magnetic fields and then resonance RF causing them to flip, I don't know. I think you start to lose some people on a radio.
There is another one, lithium-ion battery. How does it work? Did you have a time to look at it?
I don't remember the lithium-ion battery. We've kind of done discussions of different batteries through the years here. Lithium iron phosphate is a particularly nice design that I've mentioned. There's lithium polymer, lithium ion, I think I even did an article on the newsletter about the history of rechargeable batteries going back to the lead acid Volta batteries.
And there was another one about quantum computing.
Quantum computing is in its somewhat early stage and requires someone to grapple with the concepts of quantum entanglement and other quantum principles that are at the heart of quantum computing. The point being that the bits are not in a... most computers have bits that are either one or zero. Quantum bits or qubits have one values of one and zero, and everything in between. And so until you collapse the wave equation that they exist in all of those conditions. So immediately it starts to get a little bit furry.
Yes, I believe this is heavy. We can start to talk about it, but it's going to be heavy. How about 3D printers that I sent you that was... some time ago, a number of videos about very clever 3D printing in metals.
Yeah, I read them. They are fascinating. There's a whole range of basically sinter technology. What happens is that they take powdered metals and they expose layer after layer to sudden high temperature lasers that fuse them in a sort of intermediate sintered condition and forms a three-dimensional print. And then they take it out of the pile of powdered metal and clean it up, and then they put it in an oven to melt it down and fix the positions and make it more structurally stronger. So sintered 3D printing has been going on for a while. I think that might be part of the engineering involved in things like 3D printing rocket engines that they're doing experimentally. They've cast a lot of automotive parts. The YouTube that you showed me basically were guys doing it for a custom experimental car that they were designing and building. So, yeah, it's very fascinating. I have a little plastic 3D printer. It basically just melts filaments of plastic and applies them in stacks up the Z-axis. There are also other forms that use liquids that solidify under UV light, and it shines as it goes up and forms a polymer that way. And a lot of metal sintering that's been used. So the technology is improving and advancing, and it's probably only going to get better over time and less expensive.
I remember 20 years ago when everything started, sintering was simply done by the presses. I mean, it wasn't done by the presses. It was powdered material, metal, that was put into the form, and it was a process of pushing it from the top and making it somehow formed to the shape, and most of the home appliances were the handles for the locks, for the doorknobs, all of that stuff was made this way. It was a high production, and then that fragile element that was newly formed by the press in the form was then carried on to the furnace, and from the furnace it was the boundaries of each metal particle, powder particle, was actually pushed into the liquid state and pounded into another particle. So the porosity of that material, let me drop. So the porosity of that material were great. Many parts couldn't be made from that, but that was when they discovered that high porosity materials could be made by means of sintering for the filters for oil in motor auto industry. So that was one way. But I never thought that it's going to evolve to something like you actually very, very nicely putting a thin layer, one tau, two taus layer of the metal powder, and then you put laser into it, and then you putting it into the form when the intake of the rocket or part of the engines could be made this way. Actually, I believe the whole engine could be made this way, and then when you have cylinders, you just put the sleeve into it from another metal. This way you don't deal with the porosity of it or any kind of weakness that comes from not really very kind, very, very rigid material. I mean, it's rigid. When they put it to the rocket, it's rigid. Yes, there is some difference with it, but I really suggest to the audience, for your own entertainment, to look at the set of videos you can find on YouTube, and Dr. Roy would be able to explain you what to look at and where to find it.
Yeah, Wes, YouTube has a lot of very useful, exciting information on different technologies. Sinter-based 3D printing is a lot like plastic 3D printing. They are very effective for one-up models. You know, if you need just one or two of something, it can be cost-effective. If you need a lot of plastic objects, so that's why God created injection molding. Per object, it's a lot cheaper, it's a lot faster, it's a lot less trouble. But if you need a specific, you know, two or three of a certain item, the setup for injection molding is way too costly. So the same thing with sinter, I would assume. That it allows for prototyping much more easily and much more economically than casting and other modes would do. So it's a brave new world. I mean, we're really living in a golden age of technology. Every few days I read about some new technology. They just discussed a new form of nitrogen. They found it by putting it in a diamond anvil and then raising the temperature, and they call it black nitrogen, although it's actually transparent. And that's the times we're living in, where if you don't read the news for one day, you're at least a day behind.
Actually, I think I don't think a bit too much time for it tonight, Winnie, but I believe we try to discuss from the mailbag of yours that you got from me. At first, it must be approved that is suitable for the audience to entertain themselves and to exchange.
Yeah, Wes, you know, I mean, I read everything that you you send me. I read everything that everyone sends me. Some are very kind of easy to translate onto the radio. Others are a little bit more subtle and a little bit more difficult. I remember someone who wanted me to describe Bessel functions on the radio, which I would love to see someone else try. You know, some things lend themselves a lot better to radio than other subjects. So I'm trying as best I can to make things understandable to people listening in. You know, they don't expect to get a degree from listening to me, and they shouldn't expect something like that. But hope they're informed and entertained.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
A lot of companies are doing the 3D manufacturing of the rocket engines, but some of them, you know, you need like maybe one or two parts. There's one guy here, he's done the rocket engine 100%, and he comes out of Brooklyn. It's called the Launcher Company, believe it or not. He calls his Rocket One. It's going to be a 65-foot rocket. He plans on being able to, you know, launch small payloads, you know, maybe 600 pounds into low Earth orbit. But, you know, he's gotten a couple of contracts from the to help him out from the government so far. He hasn't launched anything yet. He plans on putting, I think, four of these engines on the bottom of his rocket. But it's a small engine, maybe about 3.5 feet tall. But, you know, 100% made with a 3D machine. And he's got it set up in Brooklyn Navy Yard. And he's tested a couple of engines out in Calverton, out in Suffolk by me. And now he's going to be allowed to start testing down in Mississippi. That's where all the big guys go to test their rocket engines. In Stennis, in Mississippi. Back to you, Bert.
Very good. Thank you very much, Paul. Geez, Brooklyn. I think one of the benefits that I read about in that using that technology for rockets is that because it's not designed in segments, there are not any weld points that might be weakness issues. So it's all one continuous print. So sounds fascinating, probably very expensive, but the space program, I guess, can afford it. Okay, once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. If you have any technical questions, please feel free, or topics you want to discuss, let me know.
KD2NVB with a quick question.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, Roy, just quickly, your opinion, if you know about a certain type of face mask. I see an ad for a face mask that looks like it could be appealing, called an R95 mask, and it has the air valves sort of on the side of your mouth, so like when you exhale, the air goes out these vents, and it's sort of advertising that it's, you know, comfortable because it's not like an N95, the air gets trapped in. But I'm wondering, if the air just goes out these valves and you exhale, how much good does that do to protect, is the mask is supposed to protect other people from your germs, your viruses. So I don't know if you've heard of this kind of mask, and if you have an opinion on it. Back to you, Roy. This is KD2NVP.
Well, I have not heard of this specific type. My understanding is the letters have to do with whether it's the water-soluble or oil-soluble contaminants, and the numbers are the percentages that are blocked. So an N95 would be water-soluble that block 95% of viral particles. So I'm not really familiar with the R95 designation. There is a KN95, which is a Chinese manufacturing that's supposedly very similar to the standard N95. You point out one of the big flaws to all of these masks, these face covers, that have these vents on the side.
They look very fashionable, but they defeat most of the purpose. Usually there are activated charcoal inside those things. They're not really designed so much for, they're not designed at all for infection control. So they're probably one of the worst masks that you can get. Depending upon that particular design, it might be a pseudo N95 going in, and then it blows out using a guy next to you. So it's not really being a citizen.
That's what it is. It's a one-way valve. And then their rationalization is, well, they're on the side, so when you're talking to the guy in front of you, it's going out sideways, but of course it's going to hit some other guy standing over there or what have you. So I was kind of thinking that myself. You're kind of confirming what I was worried about. Back to you. Thanks, Roy.
Yeah, there's so much misinformation and confusion and suspicion about masks. You have to kind of understand that masks have two benefits. In a hospital environment, if you have a healthcare worker who is working on sick patients, you sort of have to look upon them as a valuable resource. You can't use up the health professionals. If you let them become infected, then they're out of the game and everyone is in trouble. So the N95s, and there are better, more uncomfortable masks that protect people even more. There was a infectious disease hospital in Italy that used much more severe protection, and I think they actually had a 0% infection rate of the people working there. So there are better things than N95. The purpose of face masks for the general public is more to protect the guy next to you than to protect yourself. It is not designed to block viral particles that are, 125 microns in diameter. It's designed to limit the globules of the fomites that you spray as you talk into the air and being transferred into the eyes and nose and mouth of someone nearby.
Right. Yeah, I got that. So the other thing, it touts how it feels so tightly on your face, blah blah blah. But I guess, but the air going out the one way valve is, like you say, it might help me some, but it's not gonna help the guy next to me. Maybe the guy in front of you, but not the guy next to me. Okay, so I guess that's all I got with that. Thanks, Roy. KD2MBT, back to Ned.
Okay, you're welcome, Bob. I mean, the problem is that face masks in general and very well-constructed masks like the N95 are a pain in the backside. They're uncomfortable. It's difficult to breathe through them in general, and as you kind of clog up the filter with the stuff that's floating in the air, it becomes even more difficult to breathe through them. And so I have seen these ridiculous YouTubes of I think it was an Ohio state senator who totally was confused by how life works. He took an oximeter of some kind, an oxygen detector, and shoved it in someone's face with a mask, and when his partial pressure of oxygen went from 20% to 18%, he said, aha, the mask is sucking up your oxygen. You know, failing to understand the concept that human beings breathe out carbon dioxide in exchange of oxygen. We burn oxygen. So there's a lot of confusion.
Yeah, copy that. So I guess I still have my loose-fitting masks that are, I've gotten from a couple of places. That's what I'll use so I find something better. Back to Ned.
Yeah, I mean, for the sake of not infecting other people, just a good piece of cloth over your face and your nose should limit the risk. There are people, a lot of times even these good N95s aren't terribly useful for people with the beards. The beards sort of get in the way, and they fail to allow for good contact around the edges. And you got a lot of air bleeding through those. So
nothing's perfect. I mean, some people wear a full head object, you know, especially in infectious disease hospitals. So anyone else out there with any questions? And if you have any questions about COVID, feel free to ask. I know John over in Los Alamos wanted to discuss an article.
Close to that, I have a fun fact for you.
Okay, Ed, I always like fun facts.
You know, those pulse oximeters have become widely available and very inexpensive. And as a result, a lot of people buying them now are small plane pilots who do not have pressurized planes. And when they're stocking up at the higher altitudes, it's a very easy and inexpensive way to make sure you're not too high for your own system.
God, that's interesting to know. I remember when pulse oximeters first came on board many, many years ago, being medical devices. They were overpriced. But nowadays, they're selling them like hotcakes on Amazon. I bought one myself just to play around with. It's fundamentally quite a reasonably simple concept. Just a light source and a detector. And it can tell from the absorption spectrum how much oxygenated versus deoxygenated hemoglobin is under your fingernail.
And light switch.
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, I bought one also, but I went for my physical last week, and of course I had a mask on, and I had the nitrite gloves, the blue. And he put the oximeter right over the glove, and he said, you know, it wouldn't matter. And I guess it didn't. I was in the 90s, so I guess it's all right, but that's interesting.
Well, it depends upon, nitrile comes in different colors. I have black, there are blue, there are purple. It depends. I think it's primarily an infrared absorption. So if it's transparent to infrared frequencies, even if we can't see through it, the detector can. Okay, once again, any questions either of a technical nature or if you topics or if you have any questions you want to ask about COVID-19? If John is out there, if he wants to discuss that article that he sent me.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I sent you the website for the launcher company, you know, the one from Brooklyn. You know, they show you everything that they're involved in. In fact, they have a big, long video about it. They show the process of making a rocket engine, and they have... They you know, they showed going to Long Island and they tested it out east. But, you know, it's all about the company. So I don't have Wesley's website, so maybe you want to put it on your website. There's no commercials or anything, so if you put it on your site, everybody could look at it. It's pretty good. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Paul. I'll take a look at it while you're doing the space report and hopefully get it up by the end of the technical mess. Once again, if anyone out there has any other questions or comments or topics or what have you, I see John's listed on the IRLP. Maybe he just can't get received. Sometimes we need to keep the repeater quiet for a little while so he can link up. So let's give it a little pause and see if John wants to join us with his subject question today. Okay, I guess not. He was asking about an article that suggested how curious COVID-19 is. And I posted on my link page, roy.ac2gs, an article about how what makes the virus somewhat tick. Everyone sort of by now has seen these pictures. It looks like a beach ball with a bunch of little brightly colored spikes coming out of it at right angles, and those are basically angiotensin converting enzyme 2 protein-like structures that attach to different cells in the human body. Angiotensin converting enzyme is involved in turning a primitive protein into something called angiotensin, and that regulates salt and fluid balance and inflammatory processes and other such things. So it's very important, and it's lining a lot of our cells. It lines our epithelial cells in our respiratory tract, which is why we get the infections in the respiratory tract. Let me drop for a sec. Unfortunately, it's lining a lot of other epithelial cells. The vascular structure is lined with them, and so there are vascular problems, there are end organ problems, and there's a tendency for blood to be far easier to clot with the infection. And so, doctors are noticing a lot more sudden deaths that seem to be from strokes and heart attacks that are much more common this year than they were the same time last year. And the thought is that possibly these viral infections are increasing coagulation states and accelerating people's underlying heart and circulatory problems and giving them these clots and strokes and heart attacks prematurely. Let me drop.
Hang on, Roy. That's a serious question.
Okay, Ed?
You used to take 81 milligrams of aspirin a day as an anti-clotting agent, fit my profile. Doctor told me about 2 years ago that they changed the studies. They've shown I'm no longer in the profile. Stop doing it. My theory is, well, what we're hearing about COVID-19, I should go back on it and have done so. Am I making a mistake?
Well, I'm certainly not going to make any medical opinions or advice over a radio not having examined you. You could make a case for the possibility that because COVID-19 can give you asymptomatic coagulopathy problem, that it may be a smart move on your part. The problem is that everything has its risks and its benefits. And as you do more studies, the number of people in the benefit category go up and down. So at one point, people were pushing aspirin for everything. There were articles about how taking aspirin will lower your risk of developing colon cancer, strokes, heart attacks, you name it. So, usually when the pendulum swings too much to the left, it then swings a little bit too much to the right. So I think that that's what's going on right now. Now, aspirin can be dangerous. I've had people who take aspirin and have not had a single problem. I've had other people that I've given aspirin to and developed bleeding ulcers with no history beforehand. So, caveat emptor, as you will.
KC2FYJ with a question, comment.
Don't do that.
Okay, good luck, Ed, and, you're a rational man. Harry, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, with regard to the structure of the COVID-19 virus, I seem to recall having read or heard something very recently about a treatment that's being developed that some material or other that forms a sheath, if you will, around the virus. It acts like a, for lack of a better term, a cellophane bag that wraps around it and prevents those spikes from sticking to the body cellular structures. Have you heard anything about that, and do you know anything about it?
AC2GS. Yeah, Harry, you're alluding to, I think they're calling them nano absorbers. What they are very small structures that utilize white blood cell components that are designed to recognize the same proteins that are spiked across the coronavirus. So the concept theoretically is that they'll envelope and just kind of block all the angiotensin converting enzyme to receptor protein. They've tested safety in a weird way. They basically took a little piece of it and shoved it into a mouse, and the mouse didn't die. They tested the efficacy by putting it in a petri dish with virus, which is fine. I'm not quite sure exactly how they're going to introduce this into a living person and not have any other side effects. So the articles that I've read so far don't really go into that important detail. They've tested efficacy in a petri dish. They've tested the safety in a mouse. That's as far as it's gone so far. It sounds interesting, but I think it's a little too early to bet on.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't dreaming when I heard it. And you've confirmed that, yeah, it's something real that's being looked at. Thank you, KC2FYJ, back on the side.
You're welcome, Harry. I mean, the good thing and the bad thing is that almost everyone with any kind of degree is feverishly working on some kind of an answer to this. And the reality, and I've mentioned this before, most people with a cursory understanding of science have read the textbooks, and it seems to go A to B to Z to D to E. Very logical, very rational, very clean. The reality, like anything that human beings are involved with, is that science is messy. It's not that clean. It's two steps forward, three steps back, five steps forward, a step to the left, a step to the right. It's like doing a damn dance. So a lot of avenues that you're going to read about are going to be quite interesting and quite useless. It's just the nature of research. Hopefully, by throwing everything up against the wall, you might find a few things that'll stick, and you know that's how the Salk and the Sabin vaccine was discovered in its day. You know, we have more than 100 different vaccine candidates being tested. Hopefully, a few of them are going to turn out to be both safe and efficacious, and then the problem will just be scaling it up for billions of dosages.
Well, frankly, I'm inclined to think that the solution is going to be found by accident, same way penicillin was found by accident. Not that they're not going to be looking for it, but they're going to find something that they weren't anticipating, and that's what's going to do the trick. Anyway, that's enough for me for tonight. I'll just continue to listen. KC2FYJ, clear.
Okay, very good, Harry. A lot of eureka moments are based on just random accidents, but they have to happen to the right person at the right time. The average guy, if he went back to his petri dishes and he saw a clear zone, he would just shrug his shoulders and throw it in the washing machine. Fleming tried to figure out what the hell was going on with that clearing. And he came up with the fact that the mold spores of penicillin were producing materials that were destructive to invading bacteria. And the penicillin, the very first antibiotic, was born. So it was luck, but it was also an educated man trying to figure things out as opposed to just shrugging their shoulders. So you got to give Fleming props for what he did. Lesser people would have just cleaned their glassware and moved on.
KD2NBB.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, that thing you were talking about 5 minutes ago at the other station was the thing I was mentioning to you earlier, is the nano sponges. And what I read was, yeah, they're in the early stages of experimenting, basically, like what you said, the mice in the petri dish. So that's the thing I was asking you about earlier. Back to you, Roy. Back to Ned. KD2NBB.
Yes, indeed. You know, it was a fascinating article, but I'm kind of confused where no one went to the trouble of trying to explain how what the next move is. What do you do with these sponges? Do you just kind of put them in an IV drip? And if you do, isn't that going to cause things to clot up? I mean, it sounds like the next level is going to be very problematic at the very least.
Yeah, you got me.